This is Dateline News and Conversation. I've got a great show for us tonight. He's a good friend now. I consider him a friend. I've only recently met him, but he is a longtime musician and activist. His songs are very powerful and hard-hitting. He is a prolific songwriter and singer. I'm happy to introduce him to you today, David Rovics, coming from Portland, Oregon. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Regis. Great to be with you.
Well, I've known about you for a long time because of a very dear friend of mine, Joan Livingston, who sends me emails and sends me links to your latest videos. She's always talking about you. So last week, I did a show with the Boston Community Church, and I guess you're kind of a regular with them, but you sang two songs. And I got in touch with you, and I said, you know, we have to get together. I got to do a show about you. So what I'd like first to do, David, I want to play the last time America invaded Russia. Tell me a little bit about that song before I cue it up.
I wrote it soon after what they call the full scale war began in February 22, right? And it was and I wrote it just to try to put this whole situation in a little bit of context. I mean, I had already written other songs about the coup in 2014 in Ukraine, and about the corruption of the Biden family in regards to Ukraine. I wrote songs of that nature many years ago. But with the kind of propaganda that was being, circulated on a possibly unprecedented level, although that word gets thrown around, of course, so much, but it was incredible. The propaganda in the entire Western media suddenly aligned and became indistinguishable from each other, whether you were looking at France or Germany or the US or Britain or Australia. It was just a wall of propaganda all saying the same kinds of stuff about Russia and the Soviet Union, and all full of the same kinds of historical inaccuracies and leaving out massive parts of the whole historical narrative in order to create this idea of Russia as some kind of expansionistic empire of a sort that it has never been since the fall of the Tsar.
As
anybody who's actually studied the history honestly of the past century can tell you. I wanted people to know something that I'm absolutely certain 99% of people throughout the Western world, certainly in the United States, are completely unaware of, which is that after the Russian Revolution, Russia was invaded by 200,000 soldiers from multiple countries, including the United States, Canada, and many other countries. Interesting stories, which I have never written about the Canadians who mutinied when they got there. But the fact is that Russia was invaded by hundreds of thousands of troops that were there to aid the White Army, which ended up falling apart under the weight of its own lack of a mandate, or lack of a popular base. They disintegrated, and the invading armies ultimately went home. But the Russian Revolution was a very threatening thing for the West, and it was in, and Russia was invaded by the West. So this is something that people tend not to know, and people really should know in the West. The last time the U.S. invaded Russia, along with France and Italy, Japan and the U.K., the troops came to stop the revolution. Whatever else the lying textbooks say, if they even mention this invasion, usually it will not qualify as a footnote in the story of this nation, in which tens of millions have died since the last time the U.S. invaded Russia, when it was invaded once again by more armies come to stamp out Bolshevism, whose ranks were filled with German-speaking men, sent to fight and die for their Führer on a mission to kill all the Russian Reds, brainwashed by the lying propaganda that for years had been stuffed inside their heads. The last time the U.S. invaded Russia, armies came to stop this nascent state. They came from the west, north, south, and east. They came from across the Bering Strait. They came with tidings from the White House, from the men of industry, of course. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers made up this sprawling global military force. The last time the U.S. invaded Russia, it was an existential threat. When the armies came across the ocean, some people never can forget, such as most anyone from St. Petersburg, Murmansk, Crimea, or Odessa. There are still trucks standing by the road there from the last time the U.S. invaded Russia.
Okay. Now, let me go back to a little bit more about your life. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? You know, when did you first start playing music?
I was born on Manhattan Island in 1967, and grew up from the age of 2 and a half in the suburbs of New York, in Connecticut, in a woodsy suburb. And both my parents are classical musicians, and there's pretty much musicians on every direction of the family tree, and I became one too. So it was, I don't have a very interesting creation myth, you know. My parents are progressives and musicians, and I guess I went more to the far left radical fringes as far as the politics goes, but sort of in the ballpark, I guess. And the music is not classical music, but I'm a musician. So that's you know, I grew up in the Northeast, and I did not meet Pete Seeger until I was later in my teens. But it was Pete and that sort of milieu was very influential to me as a child. You know, going to a summer camp that was full of that kind of music and those kinds of politics, and so that's I grew up there in that scene. The Northeast.
Well, a couple of questions. Were you classically trained?
Yeah, I grew up playing classical cello.
The cello.
Yeah, and I still play the cello, and I love the cello, but I prefer the electric fretted cello now, for various reasons. But yeah.
Yeah, I've seen these guys at two cellos. They're from where the heck are they from?
I know who you're talking about. They're amazing.
Croatia. Yeah. They're from, right? Croatia. I've watched those two guys endlessly, almost everything they've done. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're classically trained, and you met Pete Seeger. Tell me about that.
I mean, Pete Seeger lived, you know, he lived not far away from where I live, just basically over the state line between Connecticut and that part of New York, the Hudson Valley. And so, like, certainly, like, you know, I have friends who were in his chorus growing up. You know, I wasn't, but in the Walkabout chorus and involved with the boat, you know, the Clearwater. No, what was it? That's the festival. And then they had a boat. What was the name of the boat? The sloop that goes up and down the Hudson River and talking about cleaning things up. And I mean that. So yeah, I first, the People's Music Network was something that Pete started in the 70s, along with Phil Oakes' sister, Sonny, and various other people. And it's still going now, still going strong, actually. And so they used to have, they still have gatherings twice a year in different parts of the Northeast, almost always in the Northeast. It's a Northeastern thing. It's not a, I mean, it wants to be a national organization, but it's a Northeastern thing primarily. So I started going to those gatherings early on as a young adult. So that's kind of, I mean, I also went out to California and met Maoists and all sorts of people that were sort of further to the far left than anybody I really knew in the Northeast growing up. But, it was definitely Pete Seeger and that crowd that was very formative for me as a kid.
You mentioned going to some music camps. Tell me a little about that. Where were these camps? Who sponsored them?
Oh, they weren't music camps. It was there was, of course, like the camp that I went to was called Rowe Camp, ROWE, in Rowe, Massachusetts, and it's still there in northwestern Massachusetts, and it is located in a town that had the oldest online nuclear reactor in it in the U.S. Rowe, Yankee Atomic. And at the time that I was a camper in 79, 80, 81, when I was like 12, 13, 14, it was the heart of the local anti-nuclear movement. And so I was really exposed to anti-nuclear activists and people that were singing songs about nuclear power and nuclear war and peace and all that, and who are involved with organizing as well, who are musicians and organizers. And one of the ones I met was a brilliant guy named Al Giordano, who was writing and singing wonderful songs and also organizing with different anti-nuclear organizations at the time. But this was sort of more of like a hippie activist kind of camp, you could say. But it was also for people that are into sort of history. I would say it's very, very much in the tradition, this camp, in the tradition of camps that existed before I was born in far larger numbers. And they were really the norm for the left in the Northeast and other parts of the U.S. and other parts of the world, and you know, still are in some parts of the world today, where, you know, communists, socialists, anarchists had summer camps that were very popular in those milieus, and those milieus were the norm for the working class for you know, the early part of the 20th century. You know, there were many of these camps. And most of them are gone now, but there were many explicitly communist, socialist, and anarchist-oriented summer camps that were just for kids, and many that were for whole entire families, where people did all sorts of different things, including you know, lots and lots of art and music and cultural stuff. I mean, culture was central to the left, and you know, whether you're talking about the anarchist syndicalist IWW, Communist Party, all of the main left groups from the early 20th century placed a huge emphasis on culture, and those summer camps that were part of those whole scenes were a big, you know, the summer camps and the music and everything was a big part of those scenes. They also did things like learn how to shoot guns and whatever else. But, you know, much that was a very, that was not a big part of the summer camps for, not at all part of my summer camp, but it was not a big part, I think, of the summer camps run by communists and anarchists in the early 20th century. It was much more about culture and music and organizing and being together and also opposing things like racism, you know, because these summer camps that we're talking about, it almost seems incidental to mention now, but they were interracial as well.
I have to ask you this. Did your parents know what they were doing, sending you to camps like that?
Yeah, I think they knew exactly what they were doing. You know, pretty. I don't know how much they knew about the whole history, you know, but that I didn't know anything about it at the time either. But you know, but they knew what they were doing, and it was also luck of time and place and you know, what was going on at the time and who they happened to meet and what mailing lists they were on. I mean, it was a lot of it was kind of random, but that I sort of fell into this kind of scene. But yeah,
right.
They knew it.
So tell me about your education. High school, did you go to college? Where did you go? What did you learn, etc.?
Well, I was a very neuroatypical kid, and was really saved by a hippie elementary school that I went to called the Learning Community. I was not doing well in public school, but I went to public school in high school, and in Wilton, Connecticut, and then went to college for total of a couple of years at two different colleges and dropped out of both of them to be a musician because I figured I could. The college, the rate at which we were all expected to read was just, it killed the whole thing for me as far as having any interest in. I never wanted to drop music in order to obsessively study political economy. I wanted to do both and have a more balanced reality, and it didn't work. So I read a lot of books, but I never got a degree or anything at a university. And when I figured out that I wanted to be a performer, and realized that there was no point in getting a degree to do that. No, that's not how it works.
That's fascinating, and it's really wonderful. You know, so many kids are channeled into college, and their parents want them to be just like them, get into careers as an attorney or a doctor, or become a professional athlete. And the problem has been that they've never looked and appreciated what natural, God-given talents and instincts their children have had. And that makes for an unhappy life going forward. I experienced a lot of that in my work and in my own personal life over the last number of years. So I'm happy to share that. It's another example of if you follow your heart and your passion, whatever it is, you don't need formal education. You don't need university degrees. Anyway, so
yeah, I mean, if your passion is to be a litigator and, you know, and have arguments in court, you know, obviously that, you know, that kind of thing, you know, the degree is, you know, really helpful. But if your passion is to do something that, you know, doesn't require a degree to practice, you know, to be a musician or something, nobody's going to ask for your degree. They're going to ask how many people can you pack into this room and how much are they going to pay for tickets? You know, that's really.
All right. So this is where I want to pick it up. You decided to drop out of college and you wanted to be an entertainer. Tell me about those early years. Where were your gigs? Were you playing for peace groups, church groups, were you getting paid? How did you manage to get by?
I think it's a, I mean, the trajectory there for me is also the trajectory for a lot of other musicians who were kind of around for the period that I was around or that I've been around for. So it's, I think it's interesting to, you know, to talk about how I did make a living, because the a lot of the ways that I used to make a living are no longer available for people, as was, you know, the case for musicians before my time as well. There's it's been a roller coaster ride, you know, the whole independent music industry over the many different phases of its existence. You know, there were many things that collapsed long before my time as far as independent music and independent radio and that kind of thing, with the consolidation of the media in the 80s. And but what I lived through, I mean, for the first few years, I was mainly playing music in the subways and running open mics and playing in little cafes, mainly in the Boston area. And I could talk a lot about street music and history of it and the reality of being a street musician. But that's what I did for years before I started touring with
bands. Let me jump in. Mm. You said you were playing in subways in and around Boston. Did you ever play Charlie on the MTA in the subways in Boston?
You know, I think I did. I never made a regular practice of singing that song, but I'm pretty sure I did at some point. I really was I was absolutely the worst kind of street performer, in the sense of I really wasn't trying to do anything that would be of interest to people in the subways. I mean, it seems bizarre to say this now, but I really wasn't trying to entertain anybody. I was just woodshedding. I needed a lot of practice, and I needed a lot of money. And I just got a lot of practice playing in the subways, and I just played obscure labor songs and obscure songs by, you know, songwriters from Seattle or Ireland that nobody had ever heard of. I was, you know, really, if I'd been playing songs like Charlie and the MTA, I could have made a lot more money.
My family, one of our cross-country trips from Arizona out to the East Coast, because I'm from Maine, and we went back to visit family, and we've been to Boston a couple of times, and I told the kids about the song Charlie on the MTA, and we took the MTA, and there was a musician down there. It could have been you or somebody like you. He made about $25 on that, asking for that one song, which my kids and I sat there and listened to. And then they kept saying, "Dad, don't be cheap. Give him more money. Give him more money."
Great. I like
that. All right. Well, anyway, a subway singer. Continue now the story from subways and cafes. And then how did you eke together a living?
Well, it was, I mean, at the time, you know, rent was still, you know, this was long before the crazy stuff that's happened since the financial crisis, with the doubling and tripling of rent. So back then, I shared a room with my girlfriend, and my part of the rent was like $180 a month, you know, so I could come up with that from playing in the subways. It wasn't a luxurious life, but I could make enough money playing in the subways so that I didn't need any other source of income. But then touring began with playing in a band. I mean, playing bass and singing harmonies with other musicians that I knew who were looking for that kind of thing. And I guess I had known musicians who I could join on the road and play with for years before I actually got around to doing it. But I don't know what kept me from you know, doing that. But that was the way. I mean, it was the most amazing way to develop my own audience all over the country, because, like, I was already writing songs at that point, and they were songs about history and current events and stuff. So when I toured in the 90s with artists that were of a similar mold, writing kinds of similar, vaguely at least, similar songs, my audience was, you know, their audience became my audience, and it was a very organic process touring with these folks and then touring on my own. It worked very easily. But also a big part of the reason why that was the case at that particular time in the late 90s, you know, just for any younger people who may be, you know, thinking, oh, I'll try that. You know, that'd be great. Please do. But the way it worked for me and the way it won't work for anybody now is in the late 90s and early noughties, there was this massive economy of gigs through universities, through student groups that had budgets of in the tens of thousands of dollars every year to spend on having, you know, having performers or speakers or, you know, come to their campuses or renting a bus to go to a protest or whatever, you know, that, but the budgets that were there don't exist anymore.
Wow. Boy, that's incredible. So take me on this journey. You were traveling with other groups, and you were singing the kind of songs that were popular. I do remember those years. I wasn't a university in the United States at the time, but where they did have incredible budgets to bring in musicians, the students were all caught up in the times, and it became very popular. I'd like to know now about the rest of the journey. When did you break off on your own?
Oh, well, I was, I was only touring actually for like a few years on and off with other, as a bass player and harmony singer and stuff, opening act with other folks. And then in 1997, I think it was when I, or six, somewhere around there was when I started, when I organized a tour for myself, just as a solo performer. And then that's what I've been doing since then. And sometimes often taking one other musician on the road with me, which is about as grandiose as the whole thing, gets as far as, you know, my, audience and budget and that kind of thing. I've never figured out how to tour with a band. I've never been, never had that kind of audience or made that kind of money that would make that really feasible, unless they were all, you know, punk kids who didn't mind, you know, not making any money. But I've never wanted to exploit other musicians like that.
Well, I know what it is to have to trying to travel around the country without any money. I did that many times with two of my films, The Ghost of Jeju and 30 Seconds to Midnight. I had to go around and ask peace groups, church groups, libraries, Quakers, individual people who had agreed to host the screening. Did you pretty much have to do the same thing?
Basically, if we're talking about any time sort of post 2006, then yes. But prior to 2006 or so, there was this huge economy on college campuses that no longer exists. But if you were plugged into that, when it wasn't hard to get plugged into, then, you know, what I was doing from the late 90s until around 2006 was I made by far most of my money playing on college campuses and getting paid, you know, fixed rates like $500 or whatever per gig, you know, to and then selling CDs on top of that. So then all the gigs that you're talking about, like for a Quaker group or for a local peace group or something like that, those often were wonderful gigs, but I, you know, in terms of the audiences and they often were not wonderful gigs in terms of the money. But at that time for me, the money for those gigs wasn't so crucial because there was this huge economy on the college campuses that I think really would be hard to overstate what an impact that economy had on, you know, the number of artists and traveling speakers and filmmakers and so many other people who were able to do quite well just by, you know, taking advantage of the money that was out there with the student groups. You know, when that fell apart and we were left with just, you know, the sort of local, you know, Quaker group and the local peace group and that kind of thing, you know, that it became much, much harder. And of course, I regularly meet people like you who are traveling and with a film who talk about the fundraising they had to do in order to do the tour, which is how it is now, which is seems so completely crazy to anybody old enough to remember how it was 20 years ago, because you would do a tour and make money. You know, you didn't raise money in order to do a tour. You toured in order to make money and in order to promote your work.
I've got to ask you this. Do you have to raise money? I know you've toured the world several times. Did you have to ask people for support to travel? Because I know there's no really money to make. I used to offer copies of my CDs for a donation so I could get to the next town. And I traveled across the country doing this. I never traveled around the world doing it. I begged for money to be able to travel the world to make the films. But so how do you support your many tours around the United States and internationally? How'd you do that?
So there's different at different points. I mean, it's sort of like for me and so many others, you're reinventing your career every few years, depending on the new circumstances that you know are thrown at you by the capitalist system, you know, but and the tech, you know, tech platforms and everything else. But basically, the way it used to be, you know, the touring more than paid for itself. I mean, I made, you know, actually when I was in my early 30s, I might have actually made upwards of six digits on some years. I mean, it was a very, I made good money. I mean, I was doing 100, 200 gigs a year. Each one of them was paying $500. I mean, you can do the math, you know, that was what it was like at that time. You know, and some of the gigs paid more than that, you know, and when you're just driving all over the country in a big, you know, that's how I did it, you know, out of my van or out of a car. So I wasn't flying all over the place. I didn't want to be. I just wanted to travel all over the U.S. all the time. And that's what I was doing. And then when the college gigs fell apart in 2006, suddenly, you know, I was making like less than half the money that I had been making, but there was still enough. I could still actually make money and tour. So I continued to do that. And then when that actually changed was in 2013, when Spotify started their free tier, which I didn't even realize at the time. But, you know, I discovered that what had happened, and my audience is largely youthful. And suddenly I was no longer selling CDs. So suddenly, from, you know, one night to the next, basically, I was suddenly no longer, you know, selling CDs. So that was half my income gone all of a sudden in 2013. So that's when I had to stop touring in the U.S. I've never tried raising money in order to do a concert tour. That I've still not gotten there. I mean, the whole point of touring, as far as I'm concerned, is not only to perform for people, but to actually return home with more money than you left with. You know, as a filmmaker, it may have been different for a long time as far as that goes. But as a live performer, I think, you know, it is still possible to make money and perform for relatively small audiences, but not in the United States anymore for me. It only works in Europe and Australia and Canada. Europe, they have 100 times as much funding for the arts as they do in the U.S. And the way that that works and the way that, you know, sort of evidences itself is, I could tell you all sorts of stories about that. But basically, it is still possible to tour and perform, you know, explicitly for left groups playing left-wing music in Europe, just like it used to be in the U.S. But I can't do it in the U.S. anymore, and I feel terrible about that. It's been 10 years since I've done a tour in this country, an extensive tour in this country, and it's just so sad.
Let me ask you this. Have you ever been to Russia?
Never been to Russia, no. The furthest east I ever got in Europe was Romania.
You know, you talk about governments in Europe. I don't know about Australia, but having lots of money for the arts, Russia has lots of money for the arts. And I have reason to believe that your music and your story would resonate with a lot of people here. So you need to put Russia on your bucket list.
I'd love to.
Well, you've got an invitation and some connections to help you get around. But I don't want to get diverted onto that. Now, I want to talk about, I've been to your YouTube channel. You've got several platforms. You have a website. You're on Twitter. You're all over the place. But the thing that I noticed, you've made all of your material free. People can go there and download all of your songs if they want. That's not very capitalistic.
Yeah, and that used to be there used to be something, you know, exotic about giving away all your music for free, and now we all do it involuntarily. You know, if you want to have any kind of distribution, you're going to be distributing your music to all kinds of corporate music streaming platforms that where there is now a free tier, like with Spotify, where most people in most of the world, I think now, get their music is through Spotify, and it's all free for everybody. But before that, before 2013, when everything became free for everybody, you know, with advertising, I used to, you know, and still do, give away all of my recorded music. You know, at the time that I was doing that, the idea of doing that seemed, you know, didn't make sense to a lot of people. I think now it makes a lot more sense to more people who understand the value of actually having fans, you know, and having people on your email list. You know, there's so much nowadays with the deeper understanding that most people generally have of the value of data. And, you know, they understand, you know, if you're giving away a song and in exchange for that, you get somebody's email and you get to put it on your email list. I think now, you know, most people can understand that this is a very fair trade, you know, for everybody involved. You know, 20 years ago, a lot of people didn't get that, you know, and I think I certainly have benefited as a artist in terms of my following, you know, by giving away my music early on. And probably a lot of that had to do with timing when I was giving it away.
You know, I've been a filmmaker for, I don't know, since around 2006, somewhere in there. And I've made literally hundreds of videos, radio shows, podcasts, and some major films. And I have always felt that because of the educational value, my stuff was not entertaining. My stuff was educational, hard-hitting documentaries. And I felt if I charged for that, people probably wouldn't buy it because it wasn't entertainment. And so I just felt, as an educator myself, I felt that you couldn't put a value and a price on what I was doing. And I've never made a penny. I used to ask for donations for a copy of the film to be able to get to the next city, but I never put a penny in my pocket. In order to travel down through the Pacific twice to make two films, to travel to Russia, I didn't have the money to do that. I asked for people to help support the expense, travel expense, to make that film. To this day, I do not charge and will not charge for what I'm doing. But I have to ask you this, because I believe, for me, it's not the right thing to do right now, but for so many who are producing important, valuable content, and you are one of those, do you use anything like Patreon to get support? Tell me about that, because I'd like people to know how they can do that to help support you and your work.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the as a documentary filmmaker, you know, the statistic that a lot of people probably don't know, but last I checked, this is a few years old, so I don't know if it's if it's current, but I'm sure it's very close to current. 98% of documentaries lose money. So, you know, the 2% that actually you know, actually cover their expenses and make money. I mean, that's you know, it's not a profitable business, and it's one that generally involves you know, if you're gonna have a budget to do anything with, like a you know, make a movie, you're getting grants for that, which is why the fact that you know you get 100 times as much support for the arts in the EU compared to the US, you know, that is you can see that what kind of difference that makes in so many ways. You know, on in daily life, and how those grants and all that arts support, you know, actually plays out in reality. But we don't have that here in the US. In the US, it's less of the 1% of the arts funding that we have compared to the EU. 60% of that is for military bands. So, I mean, it's really very minimal arts funding here. And when so when Spotify started their free tier in 2013, you know, years after all the college gigs dried up, I was in a situation where, like so many other millions of musicians who were basically underemployed at that point, or make not making enough to survive, I had to think about what's the new strategy here if gigs and CD sales is not going to actually make pay the rent anymore. And so, you know, what I had already been doing for years was crowdfunding for recording projects, because I was already, you know, income was already going down to the point where I could no longer pay for these recording projects, which I used to spend thousands of dollars on every year. And then, so then I started crowdfunding for those. But then after a few years, by 2013, it was, I started realizing I am, you know, I can, okay, I can crowdfund for these album projects that nobody's, you know, paying for anymore. That, because I'm, you know, used to sell these CDs, and selling the CDs would cover the costs, much more than cover the costs of the recording. But, you know, that was no longer the case. So, okay, I figured if I'm not going to make any money from selling CDs, and, you know, then I have to raise money for the recording. So then after a while, I realized, well, but what about the rest of life? I mean, I'm not paying the rent, so, you know, what am I going to do? And you know, barely paying the rent. So I that's when my accountant actually suggested the idea of doing something like Patreon. She didn't mention Patreon. I don't know if Patreon even existed at that time yet, but it was, or I think it maybe just started, but I hadn't heard of it. But I set up something like that on my website, just through PayPal recurring payment buttons and stuff, and it was, and it's been a lifesaver. And then Patreon, I'm on there and on Substack, and I just use all the different platforms and consider it all part of the same community supported art program, which I call my CSA. Like here, with, you know, they have community supported agriculture, and I just call it community supported art. They don't get a box of vegetables, they get free music instead. But that's been, that is now my primary source of income. So yeah, that's what's made up for the loss of CD sales and the loss of touring in the US. So it's been good for me.
I'm going to make sure to put all of these sites in the description to this video, and I want to
Great.
encourage people to support you. I've been familiar with your music because of our friend Joan Livingston for a few years. She would send me different links to this, and I would look and I go, wow, this guy's pretty good.
With
I
Joan,
want
like
to talk.
if I don't know, do I have a song about that? You know, oh, let's see what's Joan posting on Facebook. She's probably mentioned whatever song I've written that's on this subject. You know, I don't have to think about it, because she's just such a chronicler of our life and times as illustrated by my music. You know, and she often reminds me of songs I've completely forgotten about that are about something that's happening in the news that she's posting
Well,
around.
I love that woman, and for a number of years, she's been wonderful. But let's talk about now the genre, the type of music that you make. I'm not a music critic. I like different kinds of music. I've been very interested now in symphony orchestra here in Crimea. When I was in America, I never went to a symphony, but we have season tickets and I love it. And I don't understand if they're singing in Russian or what. It doesn't matter. Music is really universal. But what type of music would you say that you make that is your specialty? Before you answer that, I want to say, I think you've been on top of current events for years and years and years. Go ahead.
Yeah, and when you mentioned symphonies in Russia, and I mean, when I was in a symphony as a kid, just the Rimsky-Korsakov and being immersed in, you know, playing Rimsky-Korsakov while you're in the middle of the cello section. I mean, it was just amazing. There's nothing like being in the symphony. The sound is amazing. I found at the time. It was you just feel it in your bones, and there's so many amazing Russian composers. I've always been drawn to them, Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky and Rimsky-Korsakov. But the genre thing, I mean, you know, in the past 120 years or so since the invention of the corporate music industry, which started with Tin Pan Alley and you know, sheet music, and later, you know, evolved into records and radio and all that, and became a big multi-billion-dollar industry. It's always been interested in creating and naming genres, and taking, you know, different kinds of artists and saying, okay, you're this kind of artist and you're this kind of artist, and the industry itself has been very racist and problematic in so many ways. Although there's, of course, we use language and we are, you know, doing things like having radio stations that are playing certain genres. And so, you know, there's different reasons why music has to be categorized and put into genres. But the most musicians, I think, now and historically tend to reject the whole notion of genre and tend to really embrace the idea that they're just musicians and they're into what they're into, and it's lots of different influences, and that what they produce is whatever it is they produce, and people can call it what they want to, you know. But that's, I think, how most musicians actually feel. That's not what they say. You know, what they say for the camera, you know, when they're told by their record company to promote country music and talk about country music, you know, they'll talk about country music. But the vast majority of those so-called country musicians, you know, they're doing formulaic stuff that they're told to do, and they'd really rather be playing bluegrass. But I, according to Wikipedia, I am a quintessentially foundational member of the folk punk scene of the 90s. So, according to Wikipedia, folk punk started in the 70s, and if you want to know what folk punk sounded like in the 90s, I am a iconic representative of this genre. I didn't even use the term folk punk at the time. I'm not sure if I had ever even heard of the term, but apparently I am a folk punk musician. And I heartily and happily embrace this label. I'm very happy to call myself a folk punk musician. I'm not exactly sure what it is, and nobody else seems to know exactly what it is. And one of the most popular posts on the folk punk subreddit is, what is folk punk and is this folk punk? You know, it's really bizarre. It's a bizarre sort of ongoing conversation where people are trying to decide what is this music that they're into, and is this it or not? And, you know, I have no idea how it's defined, but certainly I'm apparently in that group.
Well, I have to say that you are dealing with contemporary social issues. Your music is very, I'd have to say, for me, blunt, even harsh, raw, but very powerful. And you can tell when I hear your voice that this is your passion. And I want to segue into something now that you've been onto for the last 3 months, ever since October 7th, when Hamas attacked Israel. You have written, I don't know how many songs, but it's obviously that they come from your passion, they come from your heart, they come from your sense of justice and empathy. Tell me a little bit about now the last few years, the last 3 years, really, what you've really been focusing on.
Well, I guess genre or sort of musical style aside, there is a tradition that crosses genres, and that is a global tradition, and that goes back many, many centuries, which is the tradition of writing and singing and telling stories related to history and current events. And, you know, what they call folk music, you know, what they used to call folk music, you know, in terms of not like, you know, singer-songwriters, but folk music predating the music industry, the music of the people, you know, of the folk around the world in many, many different languages, you know, the music that people do, you know, that's not elite. The regular folk music, oral tradition around the world, people write about what's happening around them, and they write about history. And none of this stuff is in the folk tradition around the world. None of these kinds of topics are novelties. There's or unusual or strange. You know, there's nothing. You know, it's only the music industry that's told us in the past century or so that we're supposed to be writing love songs all the time, and anything else is a novelty or political or strange or, you know, something to be avoided for one reason or another. But in the folk tradition, historically, globally, currently, and historically, people write about everything that include very much including politics, very much including things like police brutality, landlords, wars, conscription, you know, all this stuff, you know, mine explosions, you know, whatever. The things that people experience in life, they write about and have always written about. And that's what I write about. And so, you know, it's nothing unusual in the folk tradition, but it is very unusual in the modern Western sort of conceptualization of what musicians are supposed to be writing about. What I'm doing is very unusual now. It's very normal historically, and in terms of what topics to write about. And what I've been doing since I've been a songwriter, since I was young, is I've been writing about history and current events. It's as well as I've written about enough love songs probably to fill like maybe one album, but I've written enough songs about history and politics to fill many dozens of other albums, and I've recorded dozens of albums with these kinds of songs. And Palestine and the Palestinian struggle for various reasons, you know, some of which I understand and some of which I don't. But for a lot of reasons, it's been one of the central themes that I've been writing about for the past 24 years. And it's not that I haven't written about a lot of other things, but certainly as far as subjects that I've written probably more about than anything else, it would be Palestine and the struggle of the Palestinian people. And since October, I've written, I think, 22 songs about the ongoing genocide unfolding in Gaza. And I just, like so many other people who have been involved with Palestine Solidarity for a long time, I've just felt desperate and despondent and flailing around hoping that I can do or say something that might have some kind of an impact, all the while feeling like I probably can't, and you know, but I keep trying, you know, just hoping that if a song can have any kind of an impact, and if it's good enough and, you know, well recorded enough, and you know, at least we can document everything that's happening and different angles of what's going on. And at least we can bear witness.
Well, I, for one, appreciate that very much. Tell me about the song that I'm going to cue it up here, Famine and Disease. Where did that come from?
This one, I mean, one of the things I like about it especially is the arrangement and also the video. But it was when the World Health Organization and I think several dozen UN agencies all at the same time were trying to tell the world that as many people are being, you know, killed and maimed by the Israeli bombardment and of all these, you know, apartment complexes and churches and everything else, as many people were being killed with that, that the numbers of people who are about to be dying as a result of famine and disease, as another consequence of all this bombing and the not allowing food and medicine and water in and all that, that the number of people dying from famine and disease was going to vastly eclipse the number of people dying from the bombardment. So I wrote this song to try to just, you know, echo that message coming from these UN agencies.
In the places they report it, if you listen to the news, you'll hear the press conferences and the words they choose to describe the facts on the ground. In the Gaza Strip, you can hear the measured phrases, see the trembling lips, uttering words so rarely spoken, eyes open wide as one official after the other speaks of genocide. From the head of each department, you can hear the powerless pleas. The next wave of the carnage will be famine and disease. As the fighter jets rain missiles down from way up in the sky, as the tower blocks collapse with each mission that they fly, as the hospitals are targeted along with everything, as the cameras show us the apocalypse they bring. With no buildings, with no homes, when no structure remains, once it's all been leveled by the ships and tanks and planes, every medical practitioner around the earth agrees, the next wave of the carnage will be famine and disease. As the Congress writes a blank check to facilitate the slaughter, Biden says he told them to let in the food and water, but they're not, and nothing happens but more destruction everywhere. White phosphorus burning any skin exposed to air. Actions making clear that annihilation is the Israeli regime's plan for the Palestinian nation. If you survive the bombings, you don't burn or freeze. The next wave of the carnage will be famine and disease. Across the world, from Yemen to Algeria, militias on the move, from Lebanon to Syria, while on the Gaza Strip, if they have a working phone, they're trying to tell us all, don't just leave us here alone. Don't look away as this happens again, while this world still has Palestinians. Because for all these refugees descended from other refugees, the next wave of the carnage will be famine and disease.
All right, you've also ventured into political arena. You've got one, and I want to play it tonight, about Joe Biden and corruption. Tell me about that song, because I absolutely loved it.
I mean, the you know, it's just one of the things that's just constantly so bizarre ever since I wrote the song and before I wrote the song. Is the number of people, like, you know, who watch MSNBC, who are just kind of brainwashed Democratic Party bots, you know, who don't seem to be capable of any kind of critical thought or analysis, who just swallow the line, you know, sort of unquestioningly, that there's just no story here, you know, that, you know, the fact that the guy who had been at the time the son of the vice president of this country was being paid $50,000 per month to be an advisor on a Ukrainian corporation board. You know, he knew nothing about Ukraine. He knew nothing about running a gas company. There's absolutely no skills that this guy had that would possibly warrant him being paid $50,000 per month. But there we are. Hunter Biden was advising this Ukrainian corporation, getting paid $50,000 per month, and he's the vice president's son, and we're not supposed to think that there's anything corrupt going on here, or that there's any influence peddling. I mean, it's just completely preposterous. And that's just one of so many completely preposterous aspects to the whole thing with when it comes to the Biden family, their corruption, and their connections with Ukraine.
When Joe Biden was vice president in 2014, perhaps it was not a coincidence, as it was quickly seen Ukraine was overthrown, more or less. This new government was very closely aligned with the U.S., and the VP was sent over there many, many times. Just to put it in a little context, that was the climb. He was working very closely with the Ukrainian state, which is all very related to this congressional debate. When Joe Biden was VP, hanging out in Ukraine, perhaps there is someone who could help to explain why, when his son Hunter was kicked out of the Navy, how he wasn't riding a train made of gravy, when suddenly the young man had a corporate job. I guess that could have happened to any other Georgetown slob. Consulting with Kiev, making millions of dollars, but it looks a lot like a leash and collar. Looks like C-O-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N. This is the Ballad of Delaware Joe and Kiev's Hunter Biden. Now it's only circumstantial evidence, but it's increasingly hard to sit on this fence. It could be that there isn't any smoking gun, but when the U.S. vice president's son makes twice as much money as his father was paid, it sure sounds like Hunter would have made the grade to lobby for a foreign power. If his last name was Trump, he could have worked in Trump Tower. Looks like C-O-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N. This is the Ballad of Delaware Joe and Kiev's Hunter Biden. Where the pieces fall now is anybody's guess. The Senate will have their hearings here in the U.S. War, peace, impeachment, who knows what comes next? But if the pattern holds, we all know what to expect. A state controlled by money, whether domestic or overseas. A nation ruled by nepotism, by family dynasties. Politicians acting just as you'd expect puppets to do. Sold to the highest bidder, whether purple, red, or blue. C-O-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N. This is the Ballad of Delaware Joe and Kiev's Hunter Biden. C-O-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N. This is the Ballad of Delaware Joe and Kiev's Hunter Biden.
You know, I've been following this scenario. I've lived here now for 4 years, but I first came here in 2016, and I've been following the coup d'etat in 2014 in Ukraine, and Joe Biden's direct involvement, Victoria Nuland, Jeffrey Pyatt, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, the whole crowd, and it's all on YouTube. There's no denying.
It's all on YouTube. They were there in the square. I mean, during the protests, you know, Victoria Nuland and all those people, you know, they were right there. I mean, yeah, and then funding all these groups, these so-called pro-democracy groups, how much money are they pouring in? I mean, how many people do I meet who are from places like, Ukraine or Afghanistan and who tell me, oh yeah, they're journalists and also, but you know, they also learned how to fly a helicopter, and like, you know, that's cool that you're a journalist and you learn how to fly a helicopter. Where did you get the money to be a full-time journalist in this age of collapsing journalism? I don't hardly know anybody who gets paid to be a journalist in this country. They're all volunteers, but somehow the State Department has massive amounts of money to fund all these well-paid, well-traveled journalists in Afghanistan, Ukraine, you know, well, not in Afghanistan anymore, but.
Yeah, but this question of corruption in Ukraine is an important one. And now, you know, Trump tried to light the fire during the upcoming election in 2016, but that was quashed. He started pointing out about the bribe that he took to fire the prosecutor who was investigating Burisma, his son, and him. And he bragged about that. It's on YouTube. People have seen it all over the place. And now that he's up for re-election again, I think it's critically important that more of this story comes out. And your song, I hope, will help in bringing some of that out. I loved it. C-O-R-U-P-T-I-O-N. Boom. David, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I'm so grateful to have been able to meet you personally last week online and to correspond with you, to get to know you, and to host you on this show to share a bit about your life. Before we end, you're about to go on tour. Where are you going?
Southern California, Southern France, and Southern England. And it's just how it's worked out, but that's where I'll be over the next month.
How can people find out where you're at? I don't know many people in France, in other parts of Europe, but it's on your website. What is your website? Mm-hmm. Where could people go to keep track of you?
DavidRovics.com. And they can get on my email list on Substack and click on upcoming gigs, davidrovics.com/tour. And that tells you all about the gigs coming up.
And I will post all of that in the description. David, good luck. Enjoy the tour. And we'll look forward to having you back on again when you get back.
And hope to see you there in Crimea in person. I want to come visit, do some gigs for sure.
You have a personal invitation.